Good morning and welcome to the 10 o'clock hour of Focus 580. My name is Rita Schulte. I'm filling in this morning for David Inge. I want to thank first our producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and our technical director, Henry Frain. This morning, our guest is Larry Keller from Wild Birds Incorporated, and we're going to be talking about birds. Who's in the flyway right now? What's that bird you saw on your front lawn? How to get started in bird watching? Whatever topics along those lines kind of float your feathers, we want to hear from you this morning. Our phone number here is 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
How have you been?
Good.
Good. How have the birds been?
Very good.
Have they been very good?
Yes.
One of the things that my husband and I notice is that the crows are back. Does
yes.
that mean that we're suffering a little less from West Nile?
Not necessarily, no.
Are they just healthier crows?
Right. What we saw when West Nile really came into the area is we saw a very large die-off on certain species, crows in particular. Blue jays was another species that was hit very hard. And what we're seeing is that that particular virus has kind of ran its course. It's in the environment. It's here to stay. It's not going to go anywhere. But what you've seen is that the birds that have overcome that, there's still some debate whether there's an immunity there once the birds have been infected and the ones that have survived are able to pass that immunity on or not. There's not real, I don't think, clear evidence of that. I've heard arguments on both ways. But the numbers probably are starting to rise again. But it's also peak migration time for crows. So you're starting to see the large groups and the large gatherings of the crows, especially people who live in Vermilion County.
Right. Yes. Along the river? Is it the river that pulls
them in? Danville area and along that river and the way the configuration with the trees and the, and the different topography is very optimum for crows. People who live over there know exactly what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. And they're, I know they're kind of a bad news for baby rabbits, but crows, we had an opportunity for the last couple of years when they were in the neighborhood. I hadn't really appreciated them when I was a kid because we did a lot of farming, and they were not always desirable to have around. But on the other hand, they really are beautiful if you, you know, and if you get close to them, they will stand their ground. I think that's the funniest part about them. They just don't budge.
Right. And what's interesting about them is they are what I would consider the most intelligent bird that we have. They're very, very smart. They know how to survive. They know how to adapt. And it's obvious because we see them everywhere. And they are a major predator. That's one of the downsides of them. They do steal eggs and young from the nest. So that's where they get a lot of the bad rap as far as that goes. But, yeah, very interesting bird, no question.
Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about is we had, there were a couple of little smallish murders of crows, of what we believe were both crows. One group was obviously much, much larger than the other group, but it was really clear that the other group, they were crows, and there's no question about it. Were there actually maybe a small clutch of ravens in there, or were they just, or do crows just come like people in various sizes?
You will see different sizes, and that's true with all bird species. You'll see some birds that are smaller than others within that species. Size ranges are usually minimal, but they can be noticeable. So as far as ravens in this area, probably not.
Probably not, okay.
Yeah.
Except when we first saw it sitting on the grass doing whatever it was doing, we thought, well, maybe somebody had a captive bird. And then there were two or three others, and so it was just a robust crow.
Right.
And the other bird we thought was kind of funny this year, usually we'll have one or two pairs of cardinals in the area, and there seemed to be a whole lot more male cardinals flying around this year than we were used to seeing. Was there a shortage of females, or...
No, I think what, and I've noticed this myself, the hatch for cardinals seemed to be very successful this year. And so I think you've had a lot of fledglings out, and it seemed like there were a lot of fledglings early that, that were out. And so the numbers looked a lot larger than what we've probably seen in the past. But nest success has been very, very good, it seems like, for a lot of species this year. Anybody who does any bird feeding, hummingbirds, has been just phenomenal this fall. The numbers have been great. Everybody, and doesn't matter where you live, you put a feeder out, you've had hummingbirds this fall. So it's been a really incredible year for them as far as nest success.
Well, one of the we were down in St. Louis a couple of weekends ago at my brother-in-law's, and he had put out about five or six hummingbird feeders and had one hummingbird. I can't tell hummingbird male from female. It was a beautiful bird, kind of purple with a red green with a purple back. That was it. he looked like he was going to die keeping everybody away from the feeders.
Right.
And they were all full. I mean, it wasn't like he was in want, but there must have been 20 or 30 birds, and this little guy was going crazy trying to keep the rest of them away.
Right, yeah. He's exhibiting a territorial response. Mm-hmm. He's trying to protect his food source, what mm-hmm. he thinks is his. It's very common. Anybody who puts a hummingbird feeder out, you're going to see that, especially in the fall migration. They're not going through courtship, so they're not trying to pair up. It's mm-hmm. basically every bird for himself.
Yeah.
And there's a real easy way to stop that as mm-hmm. far as getting more hummingbirds in your yard and stop a lot of that competition. And the main thing is do multiple feeders, but mm-hmm. when you're standing at one feeder, you should not be able to see the other feeder.
Oh.
So, for example, if you put a feeder in the front yard and the backyard, mm-hmm. you're actually going to get more hummingbirds in your yard during the migration time because one hummingbird cannot protect both feeders.
No matter how hard he tries.
Right, and you might have one hummingbird protecting each feeder, mm-hmm. but you're not going to have that one dominating everything. So it's best usually to separate those feeders out.
Hmm. Because this little guy, he was just running himself ragged. It was just amazing to watch
right.
how territorial he had gotten
right.
about all three of those feeders in the backyard. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, and another thing, the hummingbirds, there's a lot of myth and a lot of old wives' tales about hummingbirds mm-hmm. and as far as what you should do, what you shouldn't do, how they migrate. The old saying was Labor Day, you had to have your feeders down because if you didn't take your bird feeder down, the hummingbird's going to stay here. He's going to freeze to death and die. The instinct to migrate is mm-hmm. the strongest instinct really birds have besides procreation.
Yeah.
And hummingbirds are going to stay here for as long as they want to, mm-hmm. and they're going to move on their own, trust me. Mm-hmm. Usually by the end of September to all the way up to Halloween even, we'll see hummingbirds.
Okay.
Not as many as we do at the first part of September, because obviously those numbers have started moving south. We've had few instances over the last few years. Thanksgiving, we've had hummingbirds around. And I had two clients, probably 6 or 7 years ago, that had hummingbirds on Christmas Eve.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. And so there is an importance of having that bird feeder out, especially mm-hmm. when mornings we get down to around freezing,
mm-hmm.
but it's been warm during the day. Those hummingbirds are looking for a real quick energy source during the morning hours mm-hmm. when they get out of their torpid state. And by having those feeders, you are actually helping them in, mm-hmm. in a certain way, so it can help them do that migration. But they're going to leave on their own. You don't have to worry about them sticking around and freezing out.
And if you do get one that's silly enough to stay as late as Christmas, there's something not going on right there.
Right, yeah, there's something wrong there. There's mm-hmm. no question. And usually in those circumstances, you'll see them. They'll actually get up and finally move. But, mm-hmm. of course, you can't really tell whether they did freeze to death because of extreme temperature or not. Mm-hmm. You'll never know.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of bird there to
right.
keep them warm.
Exactly.
We've got a caller on line number 4 from Aurora. Good morning. Hello? Hello, Aurora, are you there? I don't think so. Well, we'll come back to line number 4 in just a little bit. There seems to be kind of a glitch in the system here. We'll figure it out. But who's in the flyway right now? Who should we be looking for?
Right now, when we get into September, we see a lot of our neotropicals migrating through. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon to see, for example, rose-breasted grosbeaks. Oh. During springtime in May, mm-hmm. everybody sees them at their bird feeder. They might have them for several weeks at a time during that migration period. Everybody's excited because it's a beautiful new bird mm-hmm. that shows up. They actually do come back through in the fall, but the difference is in the fall, we don't have the coloration of the birds because mm-hmm. they're not in breeding plumages. We have a lot of immature birds, so they don't look as colorful as uh-huh. they will in the next spring. And also that fall migration in central Illinois anyway, it tends to be a fleeting moment. They're here one day and gone the next.
Mm-hmm.
So usually starting first part of September, we'll see the neotropicals start to migrate through. Some of the early waterfowl will start to migrate through, such as mm-hmm. the blue-winged teal are coming through then.
Oh.
And the hummingbirds, of course, are starting to show up. But once we get into latter part of September, all those neotropicals are pretty much gone for the mm-hmm. most part. And then we start to get that transition of what we would call our winter bird showing up. We'll start seeing juncos showing up.
Mm-hmm.
I've had red-breasted nuthatches, quite a few of them actually this year
oh.
already. So we're starting to see some of those mm-hmm. from the north country are starting to show back up. If you follow the weather patterns, watch when there's a cold front during this time of year, you're going to see movement. There's no question.
Oh, okay. That's a good tip. One of the things that we had noticed was this year, which was kind of unusual for there's a pond behind our house. It was loaded with ducks.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first year. Usually it's full of Canada geese. everybody's favorite bird.
Right.
And one of the neighbors thought, well, maybe the ducks scared them away. And I'm thinking, I can't imagine that. But I can't figure where the ducks came from. I mean, this pond's been there for years and years and years. And suddenly, there's about 6 or 8 breeding pairs with ducklings and then a whole lot of general duck action.
Right. It's just the way it is this year. Who knows? There's no rhyme nor reason for it. They obviously moved into the territory, found it optimum for breeding and for raising a clutch.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had the nesting. They're there all summer, basically. Food source must have been good, cover must have been good, and protection mm-hmm. must have been good.
Yeah.
As far as the geese, they're the same as the ducks. They move in and out of territories, mm-hmm. and you never know what you're going to see where.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people were happy to see the Canada geese kind of diminish in popularity. As beautiful as they are to watch, they were kind of messy.
Yes.
Our caller is back on line 4 from Aurora. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I was on the annual birding Illinois Audubon trip up, and we were in Rockford area.
Okay.
And we had a beautiful sighting of a green-breasted mango, a hummingbird, all the way from Venezuela.
Yep.
What a rare sighting.
Yeah, that is.
I never thought I'd go up to Rockford and get a lifer.
Yeah, that's amazing. We see that every now and then we will get one of those tropical hummingbirds for whatever reason. We've had reportings up as high as in mm-hmm. Michigan before. They just show up out of the blue. You never know about it. In Illinois, our most common accidental on the hummingbirds is the rufous, and they're located in the western United States, but we do see them from time to time in Illinois also. But the one you're describing,
Rufus side of the hummingbird we see east of the Mississippi?
Actually, the one east of the Mississippi technically is the ruby-throated hummingbird.
I mean ruby-throated.
Yes,
sorry, that was my error, ruby-throated.
Yep. Yeah, the Rufus is an accidental. He does show up every now and then. Mm-hmm. And we tell people that if you see a hummingbird that has brown on it, not the green, but the brown, or any other strange colorations, to contact us. Mm-hmm. And then we usually get that into contact with the state ornithologist, and someone will go out and check that and try to confirm it.
I was put my hummingbird feeders out to get the birds, the hummers, going migrating back south.
Right. Yeah, they're definitely coming through right now. The numbers are not quite as high this week as they have been in the last few weeks, but there's still plenty. I know when I woke up this morning, I had hummingbirds on both feeders this morning. So, yeah, they're still moving through, so you'll definitely still see them.
Is it a quarter cup of sugar to 3 cups of water? Could you give me the recipe again, please?
Yeah, the appropriate ratio is 4 to 1, so a quarter cup to 1 cup, and you need to boil the water to dissolve the sugar.
Yes.
And then remember to change that nectar and clean the feeder every 3 to 4 days.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you much.
All righty. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. When you guys were talking a little bit there about the hummingbirds moving back and forth through, I was reminded of there is just outside of Tucson, Arizona, they refer to it as a museum. If you were to walk through it, it would look very like a zoo to northerners. But they have an enormous hummingbird cage there that they have the hummingbirds year-round. In like a netted cage, and if you walk by at the right time of day when they're really really active, the whole cage feels like it's vibrating.
Right.
They're the most amazing little bird. I guess they're the only bird that can fly backwards.
Right. And well, technically yes,
yeah.
And sideways and basically it looks like a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize unless they do a lot of feeding or actually outside at the feeders, hummingbirds are very noisy. They are very mm-hmm. noisy birds. Not only the wing beats and the buzzing that you hear with that, but they do a lot of chips and a lot of twirls of the mm-hmm. vocalizations, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
And for a little bird, they can be very noisy.
They're like tiny little peacocks. A lot of yeah. noise going on where
yes,
they are.
Exactly.
And we've got a caller on line number 1 from Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I just thought that out of interest, I would report. I was up in Milwaukee in the middle of the week, and we were driving sort of through the, well, not exactly in Milwaukee, but up at the northern edge of it, and we saw a tree with 10 buzzards perched in it. And I don't know birds that well, but my friend whom I was with says, oh, my. First we thought they were turkeys. She says, no, they're not. They're buzzards.
Right. Yeah, more than likely they were turkey vultures, and you will see them grouped up like that. See them roosting in trees. I've seen them roosting on buildings before. Of course, you see them flying quite often. But, yeah, that's a very common sight, especially in the Midwest.
Well, they were actually not too far south from the big dump.
Yeah.
And they looked well fed.
Yes, I'm sure they were.
all nine of them flew off except one big guy. We decided he had to be the lookout.
Thanks for the call.
That was interesting.
Thank you for calling. We have another caller on line two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Just a tip on hummingbirds. If you want a low-maintenance system of feeding them, get a couple of columnias, if you know what a columnia is.
On the flower?
Yes.
Yes.
They are, of course, pollinated generally by hummingbirds.
By hummingbirds,
tropics.
Yes.
I had a Linnaeus a couple of years ago. Oh, it was trailing about 3 feet. Probably had well over 100 blossoms in the course of the summer. And the hummingbirds just went crazy with those orange flowers. In fact, in the fall, it had about 40 fruit on it. So you can imagine just how active the hummingbirds have been.
They were, they were doing very well with it. There's no question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, flowers, of course, that's the mainstay. If you've got flowers in the yard during the migration periods, you're going to see them. That's the main attraction to begin with, mostly in the yards. You can do simple things as annuals like salvia. Red salvia works great for hummingbirds. Columbine, cardinal flower, any of those will work. There's a large, large list, and you can do it at any garden center. They're going to have those list of types of flowers that are appropriate for hummingbirds.
Yes, they particularly like the reds.
Yes, yeah. Red is the most attractive color for them, but I've seen them feed off of just about any color, white, purples, blues, anything.
Yeah, they may be something to do with the shape. I'm not sure, but so there are other than reds that they seem to be very fond of.
Right. Certain flowers, the shape of the flower allows for it to hold a large amount of nectar, and that's what is attractive to them. That's what really gets the hummingbirds. You got to remember, they're expelling a lot of energy, and so they need that energy return quickly, and so they're not going to waste their time on flowers that do not hold a large nectar source, because then they're chasing nectar and trying to fill up their energy loads. So certain flowers do hold a larger nectar amount, and that's why you'll see hummingbirds attracted to them a little bit more.
I have this medium-sized syningia with bright orange-red flowers that they seem very popular, fond of this summer. So
excellent.
It just seems to me that's a good alternative to the feeder, because you don't have to worry about stale sugar.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to remind our audience that we're speaking this morning with Larry Keller of Wild Birds Incorporated, and our subject today is birds. Who's in the flyway? What have you seen? If you've got a birding idea or a birding question, please give us a call at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller on line number three from Monticello. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Got a question about turkey vultures.
Okay.
Called. We have a situation in our neighborhood where we'll get, and they'll arrive soon, about 50 to 60 turkey vultures that will roost in a patch of evergreen trees. Any idea on how we could get rid of them?
You're on a, your area has probably been used for years and years, I would imagine, and it's a typical stopover for them during their migration route. When we have issues like that, and one of the issues I hear a lot of this time of year is the large, to use a generic term, blackbird flocks that come into neighborhoods, and literally tens of thousands of birds are roosting in people's trees. The only solution you have is to remove the tree, honestly. That is it.
This is a grove of trees,
right?
Not just
and
one tree.
Right, exactly. I understand. And that's what we tell people. There's really nothing you can do. That's what it comes down to. The territory is optimum for them. The roosting area is optimum for them. And that's why they've chosen that spot. And you probably see them for how long do they stay there usually?
All winter.
All winter, yep. So they're roosting there all winter.
It's been going on only for about 5 or 6 years. We've been there for about 15 years, and it's just been a recent phenomenon.
Right, and it'll continue probably, more than likely, unless something changes with the environment there, such as the removal of the trees. Right, exactly. So it's something that when it occurs like that, you're going to see it year after year. It's the same with the blackbird populations and the migration flocks that come into town. or into certain neighborhoods. It's something that occurs. It's not year-round usually with most species. Sometimes it can be for a few days or a few weeks. Other species, like you're saying with the turkey vultures, is for several months. Mm. So there's not a whole lot you can do.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I can remember being a little kid when we were living in the nearby Chicago area, and there were lots of enormous trees in some of those neighborhoods, and those big, huge flocks of blackbirds about this time of year.
Right.
It was always a sign that it was Halloween was coming along.
Yes.
And when we were kids, we thought, gosh, this is the coolest thing. Look at all those birds flying. Then Alfred Hitchcock changed our mind about that. But they're very impressive when you see those big clouds just all kind of come up off a tree.
Right. Yeah. During this time of year, too, it's interesting when you're driving down the interstate. And if you actually start to look at the mile markers when you start to find one of those flocks,
mm-hmm.
You can drive 10, 15 miles and you still haven't gotten to the front of the flock.
Right.
It's amazing how large of an area that mm-hmm. they cover. And when they show up in somebody's neighborhood, people know it, and
yeah.
they're not happy about it. But once the leaves are gone, those mm-hmm. birds are gone also. Mm-hmm. And it's a mixture. You've got cowbirds, red-winged blackbirds, mm-hmm. Grackles, starlings, Brewer's blackbirds. There's a lot of different species.
These are all tucked in
yeah,
there.
That usually mix together to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And you'll see those flocks migrating south, and they'll mm-hmm. they'll be back every year.
Yeah, it's a pretty impressive sight to
yes.
see. One of the things we were, you always know when there's summer's coming to an end and fall is starting. We were out in the parking lot here the other night leaving, and there was wave after wave after wave of geese.
Right.
And looked like they were going off toward, God preserve them, the water treatment plant. Because it was, you know, I'm thinking, wow, that's a bad choice.
Right. Yeah,
but it looks like they were going that way.
Yeah, and this time of year, we really don't have migrant geese yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little early yet, but what we do, we have a very healthy residential population, mm-hmm. and those birds, the young now have their flight feathers,
mm-hmm.
and the adults are done with their molt, so they're able to fly, and then the main food source switches from people's manicured yards around ponds to the cornfields,
mm-hmm.
and so that's why you start to see the geese flying around a lot more this time of year.
Well, so they weren't headed for the water treatment plant.
Possibly. I mean, they're bouncing back and forth.
Uh-huh.
Geese go out to feed in the morning. They go to a loafing pond for mm-hmm. water in the afternoon. They go out towards right before evening to feed again, and then they go to a roosting pond overnight. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of transition with geese. But nowadays, we have such a large, heavy population of local geese
mm-hmm.
that are here almost year-round, depending on what our weather does if we don't freeze up. That, you know, it's very noticeable anymore.
Right.
It really is.
Yeah, they're almost like noise in the system around here anymore. They're just everywhere.
Yes.
We have a caller on line number one in Springfield. Hello.
Taking my call. In the past 5 to 10 years, I've been noticing pelicans migrating on the Illinois and Mississippi rivers. And that's something I'd never noticed until the last decade or so. What can you tell me about the white pelicans?
We have seen populations of pelicans, I believe, are up. That's one of the things. And we're also seeing different migratory routes. You're starting to see certain species, especially water birds, are doing different migratory patterns. There's very large populations now of white pelicans. It's not uncommon to see them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then during those migration periods, you might even see them in a residential detention pond even. You'll see a few pelicans mm-hmm. during that migration if the weather's been bad and it's got blown off course. But yeah, you're exactly right. Those pelicans are summering and nesting up in the Dakotas and Saskatchewan area, and they're migrating down through this direction is where they're coming from. And they're just heading south, staying in front of the freeze line, basically, mm-hmm. is what they're doing. So yeah, it's one of those birds that, like you say, 15, 20 years ago, you never saw, but now we do. Mm-hmm. You know, the populations are doing well, and those migration patterns have shifted a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling.
So pelicans aren't, strictly speaking, a tropical bird? I don't know why I've always thought of them as Florida and Louisiana.
Right. You have the white pelicans, mm-hmm. which is the intercontinental pelican
okay.
that we see. Mm-hmm. And then you have the brown pelicans, which you're thinking of down
okay.
in Florida and the
mm-hmm.
coastal areas. Occasionally, a few years ago, we had a brown pelican up here in central Illinois. So he was a little lost.
He got blown off course,
right.
didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. But that does happen. That's not uncommon to
okay.
see. So
we have a caller on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
I was out in my combine last Saturday cutting beans and saw a little green bird flying in the rows ahead of me down low to the ground, kind of a lime greenish colored bird, and just was curious what that might be.
How big? Do you remember the size of him?
was about the size of a sparrow. I'm sorry.
Size of a sparrow. Oh, boy. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. This time of year is very tough on identification because those neotropicals that are migrating through, a lot of different mm-hmm. warbler species and stuff that are coming through, you get a description of it's a yellowish greenish color with a little white here or a little black here, mm-hmm. and that's right. it. And to be able to idea, there are literally books that are hundreds of pages thick that cover just fall migration birds. That's mm-hmm. how difficult it is.
My father had mowed the ditch up there this summer by that field, and he said there was a lot of them up there when he mowed there. And so I was just curious if it was something, you know, that possibly could be living here. I had never seen them before.
Is it a dark green, a bright green? What coloration is it?
Yeah, I would say it's almost a lime green. It's a pretty bright green.
Right.
It's not quite as dark as a lime green, but it's very bright green. It really took me by surprise when I saw it.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I can't think of it right now.
Okay.
If something comes to me, I'll mention it during the rest of the show.
Okay.
All righty, thanks for the call.
I want to remind you again that we're speaking with Larry Keller of Wild Birds Incorporated. And if you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller on line number 3 from Urbana. Good morning. Hello,
morning.
Urbana.
Hello. I just had a vocabulary question for you, or terminology, I guess.
Okay.
Growing up, the word that I always had heard for going out to look at birds in the wild was bird watching, and people who did such a thing were bird watchers.
Right.
And in the last 10 years, I've heard people refer to this activity as birding.
Birding, right.
And the people who do it as birders.
Birders, right.
I was wondering if that is something that is recent or if it's just that I hadn't heard it before that.
No, I think you're correct. I think it is more recent. Mm-hmm. The terminology in the whole ornithological field changes every year. They like to change names of birds actually all the time, it seems like. I think you're right. And a lot of new numbers have just come out on recent federal surveys on the industry itself. And birding is what it's called now, or bird watching, what it was called or still is called, is the second most popular hobby in the country right now, and that's after gardening. It's unbelievable the millions of people that actually partake at some point in time during the year in the hobby. Mm-hmm. And, yep, you're exactly right, though. The terminology is the same, just a little bit different wording.
I guess that's why you needed a shorter word since so many more people are
That's as good as excuse as any, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have another caller on line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Where are you calling from?
Champagne.
Champagne? And what's your question?
I just have one question, and I'll hang up and listen. When the geese migrate, most of the time that they fly real high, I just wonder if your guest can tell me how high they are up in the air. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to his answer.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Geese have been reported, and it's not just geese. It's almost every bird, even down to the smallest hummingbirds, thousands and tens of thousands of feet up. Snow geese, for example, when they migrate, and we get a few flocks that come over east central Illinois, but mostly it's central and western part of the state. Snow geese have been recorded tens of thousands of feet up.
Wow.
Airline pilots notice them quite often during peak migration time. Also causes a problem for airlines.
Yes,
too.
It does.
For example, last year, if you're very good at reading radars, you can actually see those migrations on national radar maps. The Lambert International Airport last year, I believe it was in November or December, their radar system had to be closed down. They had to divert all the radar for air traffic to another airport because of the bird migration going down the Mississippi River.
Oh, wow.
And it was all waterfowl, ducks and geese
ducks
is what
geese.
It was. Yes, it actually jammed up the radar system where they could not read and differentiate between birds and aircraft on the radar because the migration was so large. So your answer to that is thousands and tens of thousands of feet up.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You can imagine an air traffic controller has enough trouble keeping the planes apart. But if he can't see or she can't see the planes for the birds,
right.
That has to be some bad
right.
day
yeah.
at Black Rock
and
for
it
them.
It causes problems with a lot of airports during heavy fall migration.
Wow.
Usually, spring migration we don't see it as often. But if you're good at looking at weather radars, you look at a radar in certain areas, say out of the Dakotas or along the Mississippi River during migration time, you will see blips that looks like rain clouds, like as precipitation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to another radar and show that there's no cloud cover, well, that obviously cannot be rain.
Oh dear!
So that's actually
birds.
Bird migration. Yes.
Wow. Yep.
And there are sophisticated enough stuff even on the internet that you can get onto and actually track migrations with radar. So because the flocks are so large.
Holy cow.
And it's not just ducks and geese. It's all the neotropicals and stuff. You can actually pick that up on there.
Everybody moving up and down the Mississippi.
Right, right. And you'll see like during the neotropical migration along the Gulf Coast, you will see where the birds are all staging right there at the edge of the Gulf, getting ready to take that big jump across the Gulf of Mexico to the Yucatan. And you'll see that migration pattern on radar, actually.
Wow.
Very interesting.
Holy cow. I never really thought that you see big clusters of them going through, but I guess you can't really appreciate how many birds are on the move
right.
until you think about that for a minute, how
right.
much mass would have to be there.
If you think of 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 ducks flying at one time down the river system, it's very large. I mean,
that
it's
would
a
be,
very large blip on the radar.
A,
so
it's
yeah,
a lot of animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have a caller on line number 4 from Danville. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent conversation. I've got a small organic farm here north of Danville, and I had an experience a couple of years ago that just wondering if you'd ever heard of this. We had a pond out here in the neighbor's property field next to us, and they had a fairly large group of ducks that were geese that were hanging out there for a week or so, and it was in the fall, quiet one day, very low cloud cover, and I heard what I thought was an approaching jet. And it kept getting louder and louder, and I thought, my gosh, that jet is low. And I kind of stopped and looked around, and pretty soon three of the big males broke through the clouds, and they must have been traveling 90 miles an hour. Had their wings tucked back. They immediately flared out, slowed down, landed in the pond. And I thought, okay, that sound couldn't have been associated with them, but
right.
it happened the next day as well.
Right.
And I wonder if, you'd ever experienced that or heard of anybody that had.
Yeah, if you do any time, especially morning time during migration period in the marshes or lakes, that's basically the wing is cutting the air. And it actually sounds like a fighter jet, especially if you have a flock of, say, for example, teal, for example. Very fast birds, but when they lock those wings in, it's basically the air cutting across the wing, and it makes a very loud rushing sound.
Wow.
And it's very, very noticeable at a distance even. I mean, you can really hear it. And ducks, of course, they can get up into the 50, 60 mile an hour range, no question, even on a calm day without a tailwind. And when they're traveling that fast and they have those, and they're not flapping, the wings are locked, where they're usually coming down out of an altitude, coming into a water area. Those wings are locked and they are really cruising. And that sound you hear, I mean, it does. I know exactly what you're talking about. It does sound like a jet going overhead.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive to say the least.
Yep, that's just the air being cut by the wing, and this is the sound of the air going over the wing when it's in a locked position.
Oh, great. I just wondered, anybody else had ever heard that? Thank
yes.
you.
Yep, wow. Very, very unique sound that not very many people get to hear it unless you're in those situations. But it does, I mean, it happens all the time. That's just what happens with them when they're flying.
Because they're going that fast.
Exactly.
Wow. We've got another caller from Newton on line number 1. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. Good morning.
We're all doing well. And you?
Good. Super conversation. I've been a waterfowl guide for about 30 years. I grew up down in southern Illinois around Crab Orchard, Wren Lake, and now live up around Newton. And I was just wondering, is there any idea of what type of numbers for resident populations in southern Illinois? Because we have between 600 and 1,000 geese that stay on Newton Lake now, and that's just multiplied year after year. And this year during the nuisance season, we actually pulled four different birds that were banded, but they weren't just from the Newton area. Some were from Tennessee, one was from Saskatchewan, and then two other were from out in the central flyway. So I just wondered if you had any ideas or were there any numbers compiled as to the resident populations, because I know it's just grown astronomically over the last few years.
Right. What has happened, and I'm sure you know this, is that the federal government has relaxed standards on what we call the nuisance geese, and that's our resident giant population. they've allowed the oiling of the eggs, the destruction of the nests, and so forth with permit, but a lot of those standards have been relaxed, and they're allowing that to happen. So because of that, the federal government has been keeping track of what we call resident geese and their numbers. And this was the first spring, and now a lot of this information you have to realize is coming out of the Chicago area, because that's where the big problem is in that general area up there. But this spring, they had a lot of associations, homeowners associations, a lot of different parks and municipalities that were addling the eggs, oiling the eggs, trying to curtail the population. And the numbers that they showed coming out of this spring hatch is that there was one full gosling more per nest than there was last year. So I don't have a hardcore number, but what it showed was the population jumped even more than what it was last year. And
right.
And that really surprised everybody. And right. I don't know, and I don't know why it surprised them, because as you're aware, that nesting populations all across the continent for waterfowl was optimum this year. Very good
right.
numbers of everything was hatched this year.
Right.
Our resident geese, and what you're seeing with your geese that you've harvested with those band information from different areas around the country, is that depending on when they were probably banded a year ago, or at least, if not more. And what you're seeing is that they've simply have hooked up during migration in a particular flock, paired up with another goose that was staying in that area where you harvested them at. And that's
right.
why they were there for the year.
Right. And I actually killed one from Tennessee, and we have seen over the years that at certain times we may have 40, 50,000 Canadians around Newton Lake, and because it's a hot water power plant lake, obviously,
right.
if there's not a foot of snow on the ground, birds are going to stay there year-round.
Right.
So it's optimal for us. For duck and goose hunting, and sometimes we may have as much as 50 to 60,000 ducks there, too. So
yeah, exactly. And what you'll see, too, like with that goose from Tennessee, you're aware of a multi-migration with geese.
Absolutely.
Right. Unpaired geese will do a migration in the summertime right before they go to molt when they're flightless.
Oh.
And they'll usually
right.
group up, and they will go to a particular area. And a lot of times those southern birds, such as Tennessee or Kentucky, will molt migrate north into Illinois. And then they're going to spend the summer here. Then once your nuisance season comes along, which is the first couple weeks of September,
right.
that bird is still here. So you're going to
right.
harvest that bird.
Yeah, but, and that bird was actually 4 years old. So
yeah.
It had a few years on it.
Exactly, exactly. And so, he probably, for those 4 years of his life, had done the same molt migration to the same area because
yeah.
they don't change patterns very much.
Wow.
They typically go to the same pattern and follow that pattern.
Right.
But, yeah, that's the migratory banding program, especially with waterfowl, is really an interesting thing because you can see where these birds were born a lot of times or where they have been and where they ended up with the harvest. It's a very unique, interesting program, and of course, as you know, waterfowl, that is the most tracked bird, really.
Mm-hmm.
There's more regulations and more information and more money put into research on waterfowl than any other bird, really.
Right.
Yes.
Now, do you think these birds are coming, and because we're halfway in between, we're actually closer to the Wabash River on the Indiana-Illinois line, do you think a lot of those birds follow the Wabash River, or do you think more of them just have a natural flyway and follow along with the Mississippi River?
Like we were talking earlier with the pelican population, we're seeing those migration patterns changing drastically with waterfowl,
yeah.
and I truly believe that the Wabash region has picked up in the last probably 5 to 10 years an amazing amount of waterfowl that travel down that way now.
Yeah.
The water, especially if you look at flooding rates that has occurred in the Wabash in the last 10 years, usually there is a ton of water in the Wabash region, especially the last 5 years. They've
yeah.
had record flooding over there. So the food is there, the water is there, and it's an easy flyaway if you actually follow the Wabash River up to northern Indiana. It's an easy
right.
flyway
over,
for
yeah.
them to jump on, and then they're in the Ohio Valley, no question. So, yeah,
right.
I think your observation is exactly right.
Yeah, I've got one more question for you if you've got a second.
Sure.
Something
sure.
that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years of guiding at Crab Orchard and at Wren Lake and around the strip mine areas and things in southern Illinois, we have, and guides have talked about this when we have hunters in, is that waterfowl can smell. And we firmly believe that. What's your theory on that?
I don't believe that at all.
You don't believe it?
No. Olfactory senses in birds is very limited, and that's the research.
Right.
And I know there's a lot of research out there that says one way or the other. My belief is that it's a no. Birds are typically flocking species, and flocking is the behavior that signifies safety and food, and that is only told by sight and sound to
right.
a limited extent, but it is not told by smell, and that's why birds flock.
I guess that could be discussed in a goose pit later on.
Yes, sir.
All right, thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Thanks for the call.
So, if somebody is moving or disturbing the air, do they feel that or the vibration in the air? People walking around them, nothing?
Well, if you can get close enough to them.
Yeah, okay.
Because you have to remember sight. Sight is the biggest.
They see well.
Right. That is the largest sense that birds have.
And I suspect when you've got a lot of birds together, there's always an eye on every angle of the compass.
Right. Yeah, if you look at a skull of a bird, what is the most predominant aspect of that skull? It's the eye socket.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The optic nerve is very large. The eye itself is very large to pull in. And the positioning on the head of the eyes usually allow for almost a complete view all the way around them. And on a lot of species, not all species, but on a lot of species. So, yeah, olfactory, I've heard it debated a lot. But for the most part, if you look at the brain on the birds and what the nostrils actually are, it's not like a mammal as far as smelling, no.
Okay. We got another call on line number two from Rantoul. Good morning.
Yeah. I'm very fascinated with your program. Professionally and as an amateur or whatever, what do you recommend on binoculars, different brands? I know there's various price ranges. Could you talk a little bit about that and what are good values and stuff like that? And then I'll just hang up and let you talk. Thank you.
That's an excellent question. And as far as brand goes, I don't recommend one brand over another because you mentioned the key point, and that's price point. You can buy binoculars for $30. You can pay, $3,000 on binoculars. It just depends on which brand you want to go with. I do recommend staying in the $100-plus range. You start getting lower than that, the optics are not very good. I've seen very good optics for $100, $150 that are very decent as far as longevity and as far as the clarity of the view. The key things that you want to remember with binoculars is what type of power you're going with. An 8 power is the standard for bird watching. You can go to a 10 power, and that's the first number. You'll see something listed like an 8x40. The first number listed is the power of the binocular. And 8 power is the all-around general because you can hold that very steady. You start getting to a 10 power, if it's windy out or if you have any little shakes and wobbles, it's going to distort your view on that with that binocular on what you're looking at. You'll see binoculars of 12, 15, 20 power. Those are not designed for bird watching, no matter what, unless you're using a tripod. And at that point in time, you might as well just buy a spotting scope because it's not giving you any advantage. You cannot physically hold those still enough to get a very good view. There are binoculars that have ranging power, so you can start with a 3 power, and it's got a dial on it where you can dial it up to an 8 or 9 power. Those are very useful, too, because once you find the bird, you can dial him in a little closer and get a little better look. But keep in mind, you want lightweight, something that's very comfortable around the neck. Brand-wise, there are dozens of different brands out there. And like I said, the price point is the key. Expect to spend a little bit of money on a good quality, but you can get away with $150 easily on a nice pair of binoculars. But remember, I recommend the 8 power. Your best one, yes.
Okay. Good advice. And we have another call on line number 3 from Champaign. Good morning.
Hello, I mainly have a comment. You talked about crow numbers in the beginning. I think the crow numbers, though they may have come back some mainly, most of the birds we get here in the winter are all from the north, mainly from Michigan. And at this time of the year, you get a lot of the young off, and so they tend to flock. And so I think crows being very noisy, they tend to be readily noticeable, much more so than most other species, and a few can sound like quite a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I was happy to hear Mr. Keller talking about the admirable qualities, such as their mating for life and so forth, and I hope that translates into less killing of them for sport hunting, but thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. We have a call on line number 4 from Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning. I have spoken to your guests there several times, always trying to point out that the Wabash River is an excellent flyway. I've worked along it for many, many years. You can see every kind of bird you might want to think on it. Don't ever miss a chance to see birds up and down along the flyway. Many places there alongside the Wabash where there are roads that go up and down along there. It's excellent drive in the fall, excellent drive in the spring. Beautiful place to see. I'd like to also mention just north of Danville, where the gentleman was talking about the organic farm, there is a excellent place, waterfowl, water area there for lots of birds that pass through there. It's called the Heron Park, I think it's called. They have a blue heron nesting area on the north side that has a trail that goes to it.
Right. That's out on Lake Vermilion Observation Point.
Exactly.
Up on the north end. And on the other side of the road where the tower is at, there's a blue heron rookery there.
Actually, it's the opposite way. The lookout tower is on the south side over the waterway. The wetlands, the north side is where the heron's at.
Right, yeah, it's across the road from where the parking lot is. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
It's a very nice place. The actual thing I'd like to talk to you about a little bit is the amazing aspects of some of the predatory birds we have, especially the owls. I actually live in a wooded area, and we have a great horn that comes through here at different times of year. And it is amazing the dense woods that bird can fly through with a wingspan of about 5 foot. You would think he couldn't even get through the trees, but he just flies like it's wide open. It's just so amazing.
Yeah, they are. They're a really neat bird, and where you live at over there, you've got the great horn. You've got barred owls and screech owls, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, Screech owls, last spring, I thought somebody was being murdered outside my window. It was like monkeys screaming. It's just the most amazing thing.
Yeah, and the barred owls do the monkey call, and that's the one that can really make the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
That's the one. And they'll get on the ground, and they'll tumble around. And it's just the weirdest thing when they'll get on the ground and tumble around. It's obviously they're mating or something. And it's bizarre.
Yeah.
And one last thing about the last gentleman with the crow population.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Danville, we had a very large flock that was here, and they have substantially reduced. I think it's probably West Nile that's done it to them or something like
that. Right, yeah, the West Nile had the major contributor for that as far as crow population goes.
Yes, we had a huge population. I mean, many, many thousands of birds. They would literally break limbs off of trees. There's so many of them. Well, good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. One of the staff members here asked me to ask, there is a... maybe once, maybe twice a year, there is a setup where folks go and watch eagles along the Mississippi. And what she was wondering is that a hike, or is it a caravan kind of thing, or is it on boats, or is it all of the above, depending upon how you do it?
It depends on how you do it. Mm-hmm. We have in the past, our organization has put together a field trip over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally the last weekend of January. And we take a couple tour buses over, usually full of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a hiking, walking type of deal.
Okay.
You can go just about anywhere along the Mississippi River, and you're going to see bald eagles. And that also occurs for the Illinois River and also the Wabash River. So, and there are different tour groups. Some of the cities have different festivals during that time of year.
Right.
It's a great opportunity to see these birds. Their numbers are coming back so incredibly. It's a given that you're going to see them. There's no question. A lot of people have private tours where they take out on the boats and actually get closer to them to see them and to do some photography. You can go just about anywhere, like I say, and mention it. The only downside is it's in January.
In January.
And February, right.
Yeah, unless you're a summer kind of person that, you know, you really have to love birds.
Right.
To
and the weather is what makes it tough. We typically, for example, we would go to Clarksville, Missouri, and they have an eagle festival. And thousands and thousands of people show up that weekend to take a look at the eagles along the bluff area and the river there. Some years we've been there and seen 500-plus eagles in one day.
Wow.
Other years we struggle to see a couple. So it just depends on the weather and what's going on. But like I said, it is a very easy opportunity to see bald eagles in their natural habitat, especially nowadays. The numbers are so high. Even in central Illinois, we have some of our lakes around here that have nesting pairs now, and they're very successful with it. So we're starting to see them more and more.
Well, we were at a one of the local pet food stores. We were buying cat food, had a bird education group there, and they had some owls, one very large owl. She had a broken wing. That's why she was with, I think she was with the university. It was their bird display. And then one was very, very tiny. I mean, she must have been about, maybe 6 inches tall. And her whole, if you looked right at her, she couldn't have been much more than 2 inches wide. That was the image that you had. It's this tiny little rectangle of a creature. And it's the smallest owl in the area.
It's a saw-wit.
A saw-wit. Because I beat myself up trying to remember what she was called.
Yeah.
And it was like they had a great horned owl, and then they had this little tiny owl. And it looked like this was the doll that the other owl would carry around if it was a child. And it was amazing the difference in the size.
Yes. And, Solwits, they're I wouldn't say they're extremely common, but they are in the area.
Mm-hmm.
They're hard to see because of what you just described, the size.
Right.
So they usually go unnoticed. Mm-hmm. Allerton Park is a great area for Solwit owls. We definitely see them there quite often. And a lot of different areas where you've got trees and particularly pines, you'll see them a lot of times in the pine-type groves areas throughout Illinois.
And somebody else asked me to ask you, is a female red-tailed hawk likely to be the largest raptor we would see in this area?
As a general rule, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey vultures, though, have a larger wingspan, and they're a bird of prey also. But the bald eagle, of course, is going to be trumping that also.
Right.
So the bald eagle is going to be the largest. The most common, though, is typically the red-tailed hawk. And generally in birds of prey species, not always the rule, but as a general rule, females are larger.
Yes. And that's because do they do most of the hunting for the chicks? Or
no,
most
of that's shared. Yeah, certain species do a certain amount of work with the rearing of the young. But just the general physiological aspect of the females are typically a little bit larger.
Okay. Well, we've got 3 seconds before we have to clear the decks here. I want to say thank you to Larry Keller from Wild Birds Incorporated for being our guest this morning and invite you to stay tuned for the second hour of Focus 580.